This week, we are now starting a new sermon series, and this one's going to be on the Song of Songs. It's one of my favorite books. It's basically a love poem, right? It's been kind of passed down like a family heirloom for the last 2,500 years. And if you're not familiar with it, it's about a man and a woman who are lovers wooing one another, right? And they're singing back and forth as they pursue each other through forests and gardens and hills and fields. And so what I'd like to do is start out by reading a couple of passages just to give us a flavor of the poetry if you've not read it. And I want to warn you that as much as you hear sensuality and double entendre in this text, it is definitely there. I would say even more so in other parts of the book, which is why I chose these passages, actually. So this first passage is from the beginning of chapter 2. And this is mostly in the voice of the woman with one line from her lover thrown in. So she says, "I am the rose of Sharon, the lily of the valley." And her lover responds, "Like a lily among the thorns, so was my friend among the young women." And then she says, "Like a quince tree among the trees of the forest, so is my lover among the young men." Which reminds me of a Taylor Swift song, and I'll just say, if you know, you know, and if you don't, "In its shade I delight to sit, and its fruit was sweet to my taste. He has brought me to the house of wine, and his banner over me is love. Stay me up with raisin cakes, cushion me with quinces, for I am in a swoon of love. His left hand beneath my head, his right hand embracing me. I made you swear, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the deer or the gazelles of the field, that you shall not rouse, not stir love until it pleases." Right, so we can see a little bit of this dance of desire in the text. And I think the Song of Songs gives us some of the most passionate writing in all of human literature, right? It's some of the most quoted. Parts of it remind me of Shakespeare's sonnets. You could almost intertwine them. One of the most quotable bits is from Song of Songs 8. It says, "Set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm. For love is as strong as death, passion fierce as the grave. Its flashes are flashes of fire, a raging flame. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can floods drown it. If one offered for love all the wealth of one's house, it would be utterly scorned." Right, so I could suggest, you know, maybe memorize a few little bits of the Song of Songs. You can pull it out on your next date night with your spouse or partner. Maybe not a first date. They'd be like, "Oh, you're weird." I've pulled them out in D&D campaigns, if that's of any help. But it's just, it's beautiful poetry. And in addition to just taking this poem for what it is, this love story, both Jewish and Christian traditions have also made space for the song to act as a larger metaphor for God's love for their people. And so Jewish communities traditionally read the Song of Songs during Passover. Many Sephardic Jews read it every Friday as the Sabbath begins. And you might wonder, like, why this book? You know, I mean, there's also the Exodus, but, like, why this love poem? Well, Rabbi Akiva, who's one of Judaism's most revered teachers, he gave perhaps the most famous answer. He said, "If all of the writings are holy, the Song of Songs is the holy of holies. It's the most sacred of places." And so many of our Jewish friends see this book as one of the ways to understand their history and their covenant with God through a lens where God is love, where God is a personal being with whom they're in a relationship and with whom they have an ongoing pursuit and dialogue. And so Christians, too, have seen this as an allegory for God's love for humanity or God's love for the church. If you grew up in a particular stream of a more fundamentalist Pentecostal Christianity, think of IHOP, if that means anything to you, and if it doesn't, don't worry. But if you grew up in that, you might feel a little bit like curling up in a fetal position when you hear the Song of Songs being talked about because some of the ways that it's taught. It's almost apocalyptic, which I think is probably stretching it beyond what it's meant to hold. But we're not going to press all that much into this kind of metaphor in this series. I'll say we'll probably graze it here and there. But I wanted to mention that both traditions have validated that as a useful way to read the book. This summer, what we're going to do is we're going to be looking at the song primarily through ecological and literary lenses, right? So looking at it both as poetry and as a work of ecology, just to see what that might invite us to consider in our own spirituality and what that means for our orientation to the world around us. So let me ask you a question. Have you ever found yourself in a situation out in nature where you were reminded of how small you are as a human? Like the first thing that comes to my mind was when I was up camping near Pictured Rocks when I was in my early 20s up in the UP, and laying on the beach at Lake Superior at night and just looking up at the sky at night and seeing more stars than I had ever seen before in my life, and just feeling that existential wonder, right? Like, what a small speck in the universe I am. And maybe you've felt like that. Maybe you've looked out on the ocean during a big storm, or the mountains, or the Grand Canyon. I was just talking with someone who was just there. I remember being there when I was 15 and just being like, whoa, the sense of the age of the earth and just how young I am in it. Or I think of that time in middle school when we were out on a speedboat with our middle school leader we were water skiing or something, and then all of a sudden a great big storm came on us, and it was really ferocious, and the lightning was like crashing around us in a way that was like, you know, lightning, immediate thunder. And you're like, oh my gosh, like let us know that, like, oh, this is a very dangerous situation. And we were speeding back to his house. And I think that was one of the first times where I really felt like terror at how like fragile we are out in nature. And if you've ever been in the path of a tornado or a hurricane, you probably know that feeling, right? This realization that like we're not invincible, that we're part of nature, we're not over and above it. And there are segments of American Christianity that have forgotten that, who have viewed humans as like the ultimate dominators over creation and given dominion over the creatures and the plants to rule and to tame them and to use them however we want. And I think we're given stewardship, you know, like a priest who's watching over a temple, but not dictatorship. Dr. Ronald Simkin, who's a Catholic theology professor out at Creighton Seminary out in Omaha, he points out that humans were never given unbridled authority over nature in the Bible, right? There were always limits to our authority. In the Genesis 1 story, it says that God gave humans some plants to eat, not even all the plants, right? We're not able to eat them all. And so at first, the humans were said to eat a plant-based diet. And then animals were added as acceptable food later on. But even then, there were boundaries that were set up as to what kinds of animals were to be eaten and how they were to be prepared. There were always restrictions, right? So some Christians and some Jews still abide by these restrictions or some variation on them. In our own Christian tradition, the Seventh-day Adventists are strict vegetarians. Did anybody here grow up Adventist by any chance? I didn't know if we had anybody. But if you've ever been through like Berrien Springs, Michigan, so down in the southwest part of Michigan is actually like a Seventh-day Adventist hub where Andrews University is. And so like almost the entire town is vegetarian. So if you are a vegetarian, it's a great place to go because all the restaurants have these like really great options. I remember going into this small grocery store with a friend and just being kind of blown away at the options that you could get. And so I would say, if you're vegetarian, that would be a fun little trip to go out there. But other Christians, and I would say including me, believe that the restrictions around food have been lifted or are less important. But early on in the scriptures, restrictions were part of what it meant to live in right relationship with nature. And I think that underlying truth still holds. Dr. Simkin says, human dominion does not encompass the climate, water resources, or natural processes. Right? We were never put in charge of those things. These are beyond our capacity to create or to control. Those processes belong to the Creator, who set them in place and then invited us to help tend them. Right? There's a few chapters in the end of the book of Job where there's this lengthy bit where God is asking Job things like, who are you, O human? Did you create the thunder and the lightning? Did you create the sea? No? All right, who are you to pretend to be in charge? Right, God's getting a little sassy with Job. And whenever this idea of human domination over creation peeks its head out in the Hebrew Bible, it's pretty quickly checked, right? The overarching themes of Scripture point to not a human-centric creation, but a God-centered creation. I might even say like an eco-centric creation that is holistic and God-infused and therefore God-centered. And that's the vision of the world that we see in the Song of Songs. Right, so in Rabbi Ellen Bernstein's book that inspired this series, it's called Toward a Holy Ecology, Reading the Song of Songs in the Age of Climate Crisis. I brought this in case any of you wanted to like kind of flip through it or if you wanted to take a picture of it. A lot of it is commentary, so it's not even that thick of a book, but it's a really lovely read. And in this, she says that the song could be understood as a meditation on our relationship with nature and the land and its creatures. It's a story of the archetypal intimacy between humans and nature. Eros is more encompassing than just a sexual relationship. It's life's endless desire to live and flourish and to create. And when she talks about the song as a work of ecology, she reflects on this idea that the word ecology is made up of two Greek words, right? Oikos and logia, which means the study of our home or the study of our dwelling place. Right, so it's the Song of Songs as a meditation on our shared home. And what it says about our home is what we'll be exploring in the coming weeks, but one of the basic premises is that it reminds us that we are part of nature. Because in a lot of Western literature, right, the landscape and the creatures, they very often serve as background, right? They're the setting or the scenery for the human drama. And then the humans tend to be the central characters. And I was just thinking through, and I was like, oh, I can think of some exceptions, things like Watership Down or maybe Black Beauty, which is funny because we tend to think of those as like kids' books. I read a book a couple of years ago called The Overstory that some of you might have read. I didn't like it as much as I hoped that I would, but I will say like a tree served as like one of the central characters, and that was striking. But in the Song of Songs, we see nature kind of tends to share the foreground with the lovers. Right, so it made me think of like editing a picture in Photoshop, if you've ever done that, right? Where you've got these layers of pictures, and it's like if the land and the animals and the creatures are like the background, it's like moving them up a few layers, if that makes sense to you. Right? That's what the song does with these things. It mixes the landscape with the human characters, and sometimes they become almost indistinguishable. So the woman in the song, she compares her lover to a gazelle. And she describes herself as a lily among the thorns. Right, so in this poetic imagination, there are parts of the text where the lovers become vineyards. They become gardens. They become orchards and flowers, trees and animals. And sometimes that imagery shifts so quickly that it's difficult to tell like where the person ends and the landscape begins, or where the person ends and the animal begins. Right, that border between human and nature becomes surprisingly fluid in the book. The poet Denise Levertov says the song delights in what she calls animal presence. Right, so throughout the poem, the lovers are described through language of the animal world in a way that celebrates their beauty and their vitality and their freedom. Right, their eyes are the eyes of doves. They move through the landscape like deer. I move a little bit more like a Clydesdale horse, but that's okay. At times, the boundaries between the human and the creature almost seem to disappear or dissolve completely. Right? Oh, my dove, the clefts of the rock, in the covert of the cliff, let me see your face, let me hear your voice, for your voice is sweet and your face is lovely. Right? The woman hidden in the clefts of the rock becomes a dove, while the man leaping across the hills is a gazelle or a wild stag. The voice of my beloved, look, he comes, leaping across the mountains, bounding over the hills. My beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. Look, there he stands behind our wall, gazing in at the windows, looking through the lattice. My beloved speaks to me and says to me, arise, my love, my fair one, and come away. For now the winter is past, the rain is over and gone. So the biologist Yehuda Felix suggests that this poem could actually be read as a love story between two gazelles. I know, I found that a little arresting. And then when I looked at it, I was like, oh, I see that. It could be read as a love story between two gazelles rather than two humans. And that a gazelle's courtship is marked by movement, by coming close and withdrawing and then returning again until a lasting bond is formed. And in some indigenous cultures, this blending back and forth between animals and humans and poetry and stories is common. And I think that's a valid way to read this. It's sort of indistinguishable between the human and the animal. You know, the theologian Helmut Thielicke once spoke about what he called the solidarity of the sixth day. And if you've been around a long time, you've probably heard me say that because it stuck with me about 20 years ago. The solidarity of the sixth day. In the Genesis story, humans and land animals were both created on day six in the creation poem. Right? So they arrive together and we share creatureliness. We share the same breath of life. And the Song of Songs seems to remember that solidarity with our fellow land creatures. Right, in that very first passage that we read, the woman doesn't ask the women of Jerusalem to swear by God, but by the animals. I made you swear, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the deer or the gazelles of the field. Right? The animals bear witness to this love story. In fact, God is never mentioned in the poem at all. There's no mention of a temple or of priests or of anything quote-unquote religious. It's just like the love-infused natural world is, in and of itself, sacred space. Right? So the song is trying to awaken something in us. Right? It's trying to help us intuit something or feel something rather than convince us of an idea. Right? And that's what poetry does. It evokes emotion, and the Song of Songs is inviting us to savor the world around us. Right, to notice the fragrance of the garden and the parks as we walk around. You know, I'm a gardener, and a couple of years back, I read an article in the New York Times that kind of changed my life. It was called Gardening for Scent. And because of that, I added like double tuberose and Virginia stock, if those mean anything to you, because it's like you're trying to sort of like bring the whole senses into the garden. Or you know what I love right now is jasmine vines, which are invasive. So I don't plant them, but I will say I enjoy them. There's somebody has invasive jasmine vines all down the alley behind our house, and so when I walk through there, like you can smell that stuff 50 yards away, and it's in full bloom right now, right? And so I think the Song of Songs is inviting us to savor that, to notice, to really hear the birds, and to watch the movement of the animals, and to pay attention to the trees, and to experience ourselves as participants in the living world, rather than like observers standing outside of it. Aldo Leopold is one of the great ecological thinkers of the last century. We have a kid in this church who's named after him, little Leo. Actually, our Tuesday morning book group read Sandcounting Almanac a few years back. Anyway, he argued in The Land Ethic that our understanding of community needs to expand. And he said that the boundaries of community should include soils and waters and plants and animals. Right, to just remind us that community is larger than humanity. And so I'd like to suggest a spiritual practice each week as we go through this. I don't usually do that, but I thought this might be a nice time during summer. Nothing hard. You don't have to think about it as homework unless you're like, I love homework. I'm great at homework. Then that's fine if that's motivating. But I just wanted to suggest carving out maybe 20 minutes this week to watch animals. Doesn't matter what kind. If you've got a bird feeder and want to watch it, or maybe you live in an apartment, like go to a park and look at the animals there, or get down on your belly and watch an ant for 20 minutes. But 20 minutes is a significant chunk of time. Right? And just look at the animals and just wonder about them and how they interact with the world and what they're looking for. You know, what do they need? And appreciate their beauty. Especially, I know that can be a little bit hard if you've got kids home for the summer, but like, you know, ask them to do it too, or use it as an excuse with your partner and be like, I need 20 minutes. This is like a spiritual thing for church, right? I need 20 minutes to myself. I'm going to leave you with a poem by Mary Oliver. It's called Backyard. She said, I had no time to haul out all the dead stuff, so it hung, limp or dry, wherever the wind swung it, over or down or across. All summer it stayed that way, untrimmed and thickened. The paths grew damp and uncomfortable and mossy until nobody could get through but a mouse or a shadow. Blackberries, ferns, leaves, litter totally without direction management supervision. The birds loved it. All right. We're going to have a little meditation. You know, often we take a couple of minutes of silence or guided meditation. It's been a while since we did a guided meditation, and so we're going to try that this morning if you would like to. So just start us out by inviting you to take a deep breath and just relax into your chair. And just imagine yourself in a place in nature where you feel at ease. And once you've identified that place, just take a moment to notice where you are. Notice the colors around you, the quality of the light, what you're hearing, what you're smelling, what the air feels like on your skin. And as you stand or sit in this place, become aware that you belong here. That the earth beneath you supports you. That the air fills your lungs. And that you're part of this living world. And we'll just take a few moments to enjoy being there. Now imagine that God, however you understand God, is present in this place. Just take a moment to notice how God's Spirit seems to come to you and where you notice it. Is there something you'd like to ask the Spirit to turn their attention to while you're just sitting there in this space? Spirit, we thank you for your presence. We thank you for your attention to these things. We ask that you would help teach us to notice and to wonder and to live as a grateful participant in this beautiful and fragile world. Amen.